This is John Shanklin, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 29th of November 2013. John Shanklin, Part 1.
Jonathan Shanklin, born 1953, September the 29th, in Wrexham, Denbighshire.
Oh, right, North Wales.
North Wales.
I live in Shrewsbury, so I know.
Right, yep. Yeah. I was in Shrewsbury in September, actually.
Professionally?
Amateurly, because I'm also a botanist. In fact, I've just been appointed the co-recorder for Cambridgeshire. And there was a recorders conference at the Gateway.
Would you say your father was an educated man?
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Dad's was a consultant geologist for McAlpine's, the big construction company. And so he'd go off prospecting all over the place. I remember when I was a child, he had several visits to South Africa, where he's away for months at a time. Probably rather like me going to the Antarctic for months at a time and sort of repaying the compliment, if you like. Mum was also a geologist, but mostly a mother. But they were both members of the Liverpool Geological Society, and Dad at one time was a president of it. And they had regular excursions, and as children, myself and my brother would be packed into the bus, which would go down lanes that were very, very narrow, and bus drivers tended to think, "Oh, don't like this." And in the end, they sent us the oldest, grottiest buses that they had, so they didn't mind getting scratched. But yes, Dad was very much a university graduate, and so in many ways, I followed in his footsteps.
Well, yeah, you didn't, though. See, how come you're not a geologist?
Well, I did geology at Part One at Cambridge, so I did do some geology. And I actually have done some geology in the Antarctic because on one occasion when I was at Faraday, as was, Vernadsky as is now, I was wandering and looking at the rocks and found sedimentary material there. And at that time, this was thought to be purely volcanic and no fluvial material at all. So that was sort of a little chunk in the evidence. And I've also published a sort of semi-geological paper, because one of the things that used to be done at Faraday was the regular radiosonde launches, and they generated the hydrogen by a chemical means, and the waste material from that was piled in a big heap. And I collected some specimens from this heap, and that then went into a geological paper that was published in a chemical-type geological magazine.
What deflected you at Cambridge from your illustrious career in geology then?
I'd always wanted to be an astronomer, really. So to be an astronomer, you couldn't actually do geology, so it was physics was the thing. It turned out that I wasn't terribly good at maths, but I was competent at experimental physics. So in the part two exams, I specialised in experimental physics. But the experimental physics was more sort of geophysics, where I could make it that. So we had various geophysics field courses where we sort of did things like letting off explosives to measure strata below ground, and used resistivity measurements for mapping a Roman road. So lots of exciting things like that. And in the end, I didn't go into astronomy professionally because my degree wasn't good enough for that. So I joined the Antarctic Survey instead.
Straight from university?
I did 1 year's teacher training first, but didn't go into teaching either. In part, at least, because at that time, and probably still is today, the thrust of teaching was to push all children through the exam syllabus in a very narrow window, irrespectively of whether the children were capable of doing the syllabus. And I thought that's a total waste of time. You can teach all abilities, things that are relevant to them, but not if you're constrained by that syllabus. So I didn't really get on with the national curriculum it wasn't that then, but it basically was teaching to an exam syllabus for the least able children, where you can make learning fun for them, teach them things without them realising that they're being taught, and actually give them a solid founding for what they actually need.
That would have been a career as a physics teacher, would it? That would
be a career as a physics teacher. But having done that, because I now quite often go out to the schools and give public talks, that really has equipped me very well for being able to pitch the talks at the level that the majority of people there will understand, which I think many of my colleagues who've never done any teaching try and give a talk to a general audience, and they pitch it at far too high a level. And working out which things you can leave out, which things you can simplify, and how you simplify them, that's quite an important part of the teacher training.
Let's just pursue that for a minute, because I know it's the other end of the story, it's the far end of the story, but how do you avoid being a doom and gloom merchant when speaking to children in schools? So there's a quote in one of your lectures online about the fact we need three planets to carry on as we are, because we're running out of resources.
Yeah.
So that's a difficult message to deliver to idealistic youngsters.
They take it on board very easily, because it's fairly obvious to them that resources are limited and that you can't go on that way. So I think they're quite happy with the message. How you actually translate that into any action, that's another story. And one of the things that I usually say is we have to have some population control of one form or another if we're going to survive for very much longer. And again, I think at a young age, it's probably easier to accept that message than it is later in life when you've got your own children and everything else.
And a mortgage and to pay.
And you want more and more of everything. So
do you come out of those schools feeling optimistic?
Or yes, because...
Do you feel like a harbinger of doom?
The children are all very enthusiastic about what they've heard. Maybe it's just the pictures of Antarctica that go with it. But the feedback I've had from the schools is, A, I make the children think, and B, that they keep talking about it for some time afterwards. So that, I think, is sufficient praise from them that, yeah, I've done a good job. Whether they agree with me or not, that doesn't really matter. But if I've got them thinking and talking, then that's the main...
But how are we as humanity going to convert that thinking into kids, the next generation, saving the planet? You set the alarm.
The only way you can really do it is through a disaster. And to an extent, we saw that with the ozone hole. It was blindingly obvious. You couldn't ignore it, right? We'll change how we behave. Admittedly, in that case, you could change how you behaved. There's lots of talk about greenhouse warming. It's a bigger problem than the ozone hole, but nobody thinks it's bad, or very few people think it's a bad thing, partly because of the name.
Percy Thrower, isn't it?
Greenhouse warming, well, that sounds quite nice, really, particularly when you live in a dismal north temperate location, where you think, yeah, it would be quite nice if the winters were nice and warm, sort of 10 degrees the whole time and none of this +2, which is the really worst conditions. But in other areas, it is only when there's a major national disaster that people's group behaviour really does change. And what I hope is that it won't be too late by the time we have a major disaster for those changes to take place. But I don't think scientists talking about it is going to have any more than a sort of pinprick influence on the political and cultural climate.
When you say a national disaster, in fact, do you really mean an international disaster? Because national disasters are other people's problems. We've had two recently, Fukushima, the worst ever storm in the Philippines, both of which are possibly the result of man's folly and impact on nature. And yet we're carrying... They're still generating nuclear power in Japan, and the people in the Philippines are going to rebuild their towns.
Yes, or strangely, they're stopping nuclear power in Germany,
yeah.
which is actually totally the wrong thing to do. What you should do is make sure that your safety systems are up to scratch, and it's very difficult to legislate against the least likely combination of circumstances. That's always where the major accident happens. It's A and then B and then C and D, and the probability of all of those happening is vanishingly small. So once in a while you will have a disaster that is genuinely man-made and to an extent unavoidable. We're human, things happen, and to an extent you can't attach any blame to that. You can attach blame to what you do afterwards and everything, but provided you've thought about everything that's reasonably likely, that's fine. And a lot of the nuclear issue, it's a relic, I think, of the fear and lack of understanding that was behind the Cold War, that there was this overarching threat that we might be blown out of existence by a nuclear war, and therefore nuclear is bad by association, whereas actually nuclear power has and will kill fewer people than coal, and yet there's now a mad dash towards coal, where A, the coal mining is quite dangerous. B, the burning of the coal releases greenhouse gases. And C, generally coal-fired power stations put out more nuclear material into the atmosphere than a nuclear power station does because of the radioactive material in coal. One of the many little-known facts. But actually, if you're worried about radiation, you should not be burning coal.
So what magnitude of disaster would you suggest might make us wake up?
I think it has to be the sort of thing that wakes governments up particularly. So for the UK, flooding of central London when the tide gets a bit too high is going to be something of a wake-up call. So something of that sort of order is, I think, what will start to change the hearts and minds. It could be a repeat of the 1947 floods in East Anglia. The unlikely combination of winds and waves and tides that just overtop the flood defences. And then that itself will produce us many other problems, because how are we going to feed all our population when the best agricultural land is under salt water? Nobody thinks about the consequences of that.
But that... the flooding in London is another Fukushima, isn't it? It's an unlikely.
It's a
disaster unlikely to be repeated. So, again, we will just say, well, it was just one of those things, we can carry on regardless.
You can say that, but I think if it can be attributed, then there's more likelihood of politicians finally waking up to it. But more likely, people just go on as normal, inflation will suddenly be racing ahead. We'll have famines, and then nature will take its own course.
Which will be what? The elimination of human population?
It's unlikely that we'll write everybody off, but there will be a lot more famine, a lot more plagues, because we won't be able to keep up with the medicine because the infrastructure will have collapsed. So, yes, I think ultimately a doom and gloom scenario is more likely than... the enlightened utopia, which is within our reach. The science and the technology is certainly there, but the mad rush of pyramidal growth will deflect us from it, I fear.
Let's move back a bit then. did you have a physics teacher yourself who was an inspiration?
I think the main inspiration was at university, where we had Malcolm Longair as one of the lecturers. He was Astronomer Royal for Scotland, but at that time he was a professor of physics at the Cavendish. And his lectures were so illuminating, so clear and so dynamic that you really wanted to go to those particular talks. And then at school, We had some very good teachers. I went to King's School Chester, which was at that time a direct grant school. Mm. And the teachers pushed you as hard as they could. I don't think you actually realised it at the time, but that's what they were doing. And you could learn as much as you wanted to, really. Coming to Cambridge was actually a bit of a jump, as I think it is for many people, where you find that instead of being sort of one of the brightest in the group, you're pretty much average, but you're still way above the majority of the population. And so that was a bit of a shock to find that my maths wasn't actually quite as good as I thought it was.
So what was it then that made you decide to move into meteorology?
Johnny Bass, really.
So which Bass came before meteorology?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Tell me about applying to Bass then. What happened?
At that time, I was really just a physicist, and the advert that I saw, I can't remember if it was New Scientist or on the Telegraph, one of the sort of job advertising things, was after somebody with knowledge of physics, computer programming in Fortran, and perhaps an interest in meteorology, but not necessarily a meteorologist. So I was looking for a job in Cambridge because I sort of quite liked the area, and at that time definitely wanted to stay in the zone, as it were. So I thought, oh, that looks fairly interesting. So I applied and was called to interview, and I came second. But the guy who came first turned it down, so I got the job.
Who interviewed you?
I think I know that Eric Salmon was on the board.
This was
77, I think, yes. I'm pretty sure...
Joe
was on the board, and I thought Brian was on the board as well, but memory's a funny thing, and I certainly wouldn't swear to any of that. But obviously made sufficient of an impression that they were prepared to have me.
So the fact that the job was to do with the Antarctic, was that a secondary consideration?
That was very much secondary. Yeah. It was more the data that was to be looked at, the fact that it was in Cambridge, that I had the skills to do it, and some background. I wouldn't say that I'd always had an interest in the Antarctic, but my great-grandfather's diaries have newspaper cuttings which include the news story of Scott's tragic failure and things like that, and Shackleton's trip across the Southern Ocean to South Georgia. So all of those things were a little bit of a background, if you like. And in another sense, the house where my father still lives was formerly occupied by not Hillary, but the ones that might have got there.
Mallory.
Lee Mallory was the vicar in Doddleston and lived in the house. So Mallory himself must have spent some time there before going up Everest and being lost. And also, he was a Cambridge mountaineer, so there was a sort of vague links.
Did he ever meet your great-grandfather?
No.
So it was a child looking at his diaries?
Yes, yeah.
Do you think that was a contributory factor? Because those childhood images sometimes...
Probably overall, I think science and natural history have clearly run in the family for a long time, because my great-grandfather was clearly a naturalist in the broad sense.
And interested in adventure.
And interested in... possibly not so much adventure, but the wider world around. So at that period in the Great War, there were lots of other things going on. And having access to those diaries lets you see it in a much more personal way than you do in the news stories.
Okay, so by good fortune, you ended up working for Bass. And then Metrology loomed.
Yes, I mean, basically the work was pretty mundane. It was looking at the radiation records. This is the solar energy coming down through the atmosphere and being reflected back up. Trying to work out when the recording system had gone wrong, exactly how far it had gone wrong, trying to correct for all those, working out the calibrations and so on. So that was all pure physics, really. You didn't need to know any meteorology for that. And similarly, the ozone data processing was something similar. It was essentially physics. You didn't need to know anything about how the atmosphere was supposed to work. And the only bit which did require some knowledge of meteorology was processing the synoptic weather observations and trying to correct for failures in the observers, or supposed failures in the observers. And Joe Farman had written a program that went through all the observations and picked out what he thought were errors. And then it was my job to go through the computer output, communicate with the guys on the stations and tell them, you've got your observations wrong. And mostly they didn't think they had made the observations wrongly. And it wasn't really until I actually went south myself that I was forced to agree with them and decide that Joe's program possibly wasn't quite as good as he thought it was, that you can get some circumstances where the meteorology supposedly says you can't have that, but actually in the Antarctic you can.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, one of the classic things was snow from stratocumulus. And Joe's program said, no, that's totally impossible. Stratocumulus never gives precipitation. And then go south. Oh, that's definitely snowflakes coming out of it. And that's definitely stratocumulus. And there's no argument about it. So the Antarctic does give you weather that the books perhaps don't allow you to have. And it was really on the strength of processing that meteorological data and arguing that, look, to really understand it, I need to go there to see what it's like firsthand, that led to the first trip down. It was more looking at the weather firsthand than it was taking the Dobson instrument down, although taking the Dobson was a big part of it.
I'll come back to your first trip in a moment, and we are darting around, but it doesn't matter at all. That division between the desk in Cambridge and the snowy field in the Antarctic has bedeviled Antarctic science, certainly in the past.
Yeah.
And that was a big concern when you started doing your ozone work. Are the readings correct that come back from the Antarctic, because they're being done by fairly untutored men with frozen fingers? That's been a constant problem, hasn't it?
For Bass as a whole, I think it certainly does. Knowing your data firsthand, I think, is always quite important. So if you're going to be working on things, understanding how it's collected is essential. And I would definitely encourage Bass to send people down, even if they're just working theoretically on data, to give them that first-hand knowledge of what it's actually like. Some people find that annoying because it doesn't match the expectations of the theoretical model or whatever. And some people just prefer working in ignorance of the real world, because the mathematical world is so much cleaner and everything. But again, because I was an experimental physicist, wanting to know the experiment, if you like, from start to finish is quite important. And if you don't understand the experiment from start to finish, you'll never understand when things have gone wrong with it. So I was lucky I did eventually get to go to the Antarctic, and consequently I think I've got a much better appreciation than many of the people working here of both, if you like, the meteorology and the physics and the difficulty of making measurements in the Antarctic. And I think all of that is very important.
When you joined Bass, ozone recordings have been going for 20 years since the IGI. Yeah. Why? Why was anybody bothering in the innocent days of the 1950s to measure the ozone levels?
The initial reason for doing it was twofold, if you like. One, it was somewhere new. And if you go somewhere new, you always make new discoveries. So I think that applies to science everywhere. If you can push the boundaries in any direction, you'll make new discoveries. Secondly, it was in part, I think, the original ozone network was set up for weather forecasting. So the idea was you could see changes in the ozone layer and then subsequently you'd get a change in the weather. And because that happened on a synoptic scale, so it was a very large scale, going to the Antarctic, where you didn't have that network of stations that you have in Europe, you might be able to see your weather systems coming in by looking at the ozone, and that would be useful on the station. I'm not sure whether that ever was used in that sense, but that was one of the drivers for setting up a European network. Then, of course, computers came along and you could do the forecasting that way instead. But for the Antarctic, I think primarily it's somewhere new, it's not been done before. Let's map the ozone field over Antarctica.
But there was no kind of life or death imperative about it. So, that again, I wonder whether the scientists, the FIDs, doing that work in the 50s.
I think in the 50s it was new and exciting, so yes, you did it.
There was due diligence.
Certainly.
And in the 60s?
Just starting with the 50s. They found that the Antarctic was very different to the Arctic. There'd been expectations as to how the ozone would behave. And indeed, the first ozone measurements were totally discounted because they didn't behave like they had in the Arctic. I think in retrospect, they were probably quite okay and there was nothing wrong with them. But it's down in print that the 1956 measurements were suspect. Now, I don't think anything changed in 1957, but they then realised that the atmospheric circulation surrounding Antarctica was quite different to the Arctic, and that's why you had relatively low ozone values in the early spring, a massive rise in those amounts, and then a fall away again. And that was a key discovery that was much easier to see in the ozone data than it was, for example, from the primitive balloon data, because largely the balloons would not get high enough up to be able to see it, the temperature changes in situ. So that was something you could tell about the circulation above Antarctica from the ground using the ozone measurements. 60s come along, you're getting more of an idea of how the atmosphere is behaving. You know a bit more about this circumpolar vortex, but you don't know the year-to-year variation. So is it always the same each year? Are there substantial variations? So you're beginning to plot the variance of the seasons. So again, that's still quite exciting and there will still be due diligence. By the time you got to the 70s, then certainly the politicians and the bureaucrats are thinking, well, you've published this paper, and this is Joe Farman's and Hamilton's main paper about ozone over Antarctica. You know what the variance is now. Why should we be continuing it? And then, of course, we went and discovered the ozone hole, and that was the answer, why you keep doing it.
Yeah, but that was from the 15 years later, or 1985. So
there were beginning to be hints in the late 70s.
Well, tell me about those first suspicions.
What was happening was that the guys down south were complaining that the charts that they were using for the ozone reduction, the data was sort of falling off the bottom of the chart. And so one of the things I had to do was try and extend the charts so that they could keep doing it, doing the measurements. And that, I think, was one of the things that led to me looking more carefully at the data and eventually doing it systematically. But at that time, it was just, oh, well, data's off the chart, right, let's extend the chart. Oh, it's bit further off this year, so we'll extend it a bit further. Then combining that with the fact that we had an open day here in Cambridge, and I thought, well, there's all this fuss about Concord and spray cans. Joe's published this massive paper that shows what the ozone layer was like over that 20-year period. I'll put this year's data in, it'll be the same, and you don't need to worry about it. But the problem was it wasn't anything like the same. The springtime values were clearly much lower than they had been, or at least clearly to me. But Joe said, no, it's just the variance that's showing itself. Because of the way the Antarctic circulation forms in the winter, some years it will trap low ozone air, some years it will trap high ozone air, and you'll get this quite big oscillation. So next year it'll be back up again. Well, next year it wasn't. But at that point we got quite a big gap between the early 70s and by then the 80s. We'd got the measurements, but the data hadn't all been reduced,
right,
because it was getting a bit painful.
Hadn't been processed.
So it was written down. Some of the values had been worked out, but not consistently. So that was part of my job, was to write the computer programs, supervise the digitization of the data, and work out the final values.
So you were detailed to do that as routine work?
Yeah, oh yeah.
You weren't looking for anything?
There was nothing we were particularly looking for. It was just purely routine observations, so that we had that long-term data set. That was the focus of it all. Because the long-term data sets are the key. And I think Brian and Joe had always got that view that our group was assigned to making sure that those long-term measurements continued. Probably less actually doing anything with them. The focus was this is the data, the data is what's important. So, yes, my job was just to do the routine stuff. But I then started following up, filling in that missing bit, and then I wrote a draft paper that clearly showed that there was a systematic decline. And it was that draft paper that then forced Joe to put together the real paper that appeared in Nature.
When did you write the draft paper?
That must have been probably 84, I think, was the
version. When was in The Smoking Gun, in the Yorkshire Television drama, The Smoking Gun, 1990, thereabouts?
Something like that, yeah.
When did you pin up the graph with that year's ozone chart?
Well, I think there were two things. One was the Bass Open Day and visiting group, and certainly something did get pinned up, and I was told to take it down again.
Did you?
Yes.
Why were you told to take it
down? Because Joe didn't want to give the wrong idea, because he wasn't quite certain that I'd done the processing right, and thought, well, if you got it wrong and we say there's an ozone loss over Antarctica, we look really silly. So grudgingly, I took it down. But I then wrote this draft paper and I put it on his desk and Brian's desk and Michael Rycroft's desk. And Michael Rycroft sent it back with lots of scribbles all over it and said, this is really exciting, and go on with it. And Joe never really got back at all, other than smoking his pipe very furiously and then coming up with various drafts of what is now the paper. And I did have input into that, so some of the graph drawing and everything else is what I did. But I would say I was definitely the member of the team that really forced the issue by clearly pointing out that it was a systematic decline.
Okay, so is it correct to say that John Shanklin discovered the ozone hole?
In a sense, yes. But you could also say that some of the Finns discovered the ozone hole because they called attention to the fact that the data was off the chart.
Right, but they didn't know why.
But they didn't know why or anything like that. I didn't know why either, but I could show that it was systematic,
yeah.
which is something that they couldn't do, and also which the Japanese couldn't do.
Why not?
The Japanese had an expedition that went down to the Antarctic each year and measured the ozone layer, but each expedition was independent of all the others. So they were only getting single snapshots of what the ozone layer was doing, and one of those expeditions did say, well, our ozone data's off our charts too, but they didn't look back and say it's systematic, and we did, and that was the key difference.
And did you also not talk to the Americans at all?
Yep, I even wrote to the Americans because at the time we were doing observations coincident with satellite overpasses, and one of my jobs was to tell the teams down south, make measurements at these times because the satellite's going to go overhead or as close as it gets to overhead.
This is number seven.
This was the TOMS, I think it was. Must have been on number seven, it might have even been an earlier one as well.
Sorry, carry on.
So they would make special observations coincident with satellite overpasses. I would telex those to the States on a sort of weekly basis, so the results would go to the States. And then once we found that ozone values were a bit low, I wrote to the satellite people saying the data is a bit low. Does the satellite show this as well? And fortunately, didn't get a reply. We'd also done, about the same time, we'd done some special ozone sondes at Halley, again for an American team, or at least in conjunction with an American team. And I wrote to the people doing the balloon observations saying, does any of your data show this? And they said, oh, well, our group stopped doing that, but I've passed your letter on to this other group. And they didn't respond either. So they were given quite a good chance to go to their data well before we'd published and make the discovery themselves, but they didn't, and the rest is history.
It said, in fact, you were trying to disprove the depletion of the ozone. Your intention was to do the maths to show everything was okay.
There was certainly, I suppose, a feeling that ozone depletion wasn't supposed to be happening in Antarctica, so there was a preview that things should be all right. There were these concerns about Concorde and spray cans, and because I wasn't a meteorologist, I suspect, I couldn't see how on earth any of that could transpire. So there was a view, right, we'll see if it's there in the data. And again, I think because of the physics education in Cambridge, doing experimental physics, where they did teach you to look critically at your data, I looked critically at the data. Now, Joe's philosophy was that the best time to look for changes was where the natural changes are smallest. And he'd quite clearly shown that in the autumn, the natural changes were very small. So if you were going to see a change in the ozone layer, that would be the most obvious time to look. In the spring, it's all over the shop, so you're unlikely to see anything. But I slightly did something different, that I didn't look at monthly averages or anything else. What I looked at was the lowest 10-day mean. And sometimes that's early, sometimes it's later in the year, but it'll generally be September, October. And that was really where something clearly was happening. If you looked at a monthly mean, not so obvious, but if you looked at this 10-day mean, a shorter period where you're using sufficiently long data period that it will average out faulty measurements, but not so long that it obscures what's actually going on. And that's what I used in the graphs and showed that It was systematic.
So was there an uh-oh moment? Was there a night where you went to bed thinking, it's serious?
No, not for me at any rate. It was more, oh, this is interesting, we've got to change. It's probably due to the CFCs and so on. But it was a supposition that it was due to that. And I thought it was just a sort of, well, it's an Antarctic thing. There's no evidence anywhere else for changing the ozone layer. It's not going to affect many people. And I was quite surprised just how seriously everybody then took it.
Or did they? Because wasn't the initial... There's a whole chunk we're missing, but I'll come back to that for a minute. Wasn't the initial reaction to your work almost, not exactly apathy, but wasn't it just sort of kind of, oh yeah, that's interesting, next?
It was certainly thought by Nature to be sufficiently exciting that they would publish it.
7 months later.
That was their timescale then.
Okay. 5 months later.
It took a long time to, A, doing the backwardsing, forwardsing and typesetting and all the rest of it. So,
and peer group reviewing, I suppose.
Yes. So although today you can get things into print much more rapidly, then that was the way things were, I think. So I wouldn't say that because it took Nature a long time, that proves they weren't terribly interested. The other groups, well, I suppose the Americans were a bit surprised, but took it at face value very quickly. And then they went back to the satellite and said, oh, yes, we missed that, which is...
Do they confess?
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. I don't think there was any doubt about that. I think if they'd had longer, that again, they would have noted it sooner or later. But they had a different view. A, they were trying to calibrate the satellite, but B, the computer processing at the time was such that you couldn't do your modern fancy graphics where you envisage the whole of it just like that. So they were doing some pre-processing, and the main interest then was what was the latitudinal gradient from equator to pole. They also had to do some quality control, so they said, well, naturally ozone isn't below that level in the atmosphere, so we'll flag all the lower values as suspect. We'll get back to them eventually, but flag them as suspect. And then we'll take an average round a latitude circle for our presentation. And the problem with the ozone hole is quite often offset from the geographic pole towards the Atlantic. And there's high ozone on one side and low ozone on the other side. And when you average around the latitude circle, you get average ozone. So in that presentation, they wouldn't see it. So it's quite easy to see a combination of circumstances where you don't make a discovery, even if you've got the data. You probably should respond to letters that specifically address a concern, but that was a part of the luck. Yeah. Other groups tried to come up with different explanations. So in particular, the people who thought it was to do with the sun said, well, look, the solar cycle's doing this, your ozone's doing that. It's quite clear correlation between the sun declining since 76 and your discovery, and that's what's done it. And what they didn't do was to say, well, actually, this group's got data going back to 1956. That's two solar cycles, and there's no evidence in the previous earlier data that there's any solar influence whatsoever. So it can't be that. And that is a problem for quite a few scientific groups. They focus narrowly on their data and don't see, well, actually, is there anything else out there that confirms or denies our hypothesis? And that's a point that I make in my talks. I'm looking at the environmental issues. It's not just focusing on the ozone hole or focusing on greenhouse warming. You've got to look at all the environmental issues that are affecting us and say, well, what's the one underlying thing? Which is why I say it's us that is the problem. And therefore, we need to tackle us, not putting sticking plasters on all of these other issues.
What was the reaction within Bath? Because I guess, well, did you show the paper to Dick Laws before you sent it off to Nature, and did he comment? Dick Laws was the director at the time.
I've no idea. That would be something that Brian or Joe would do. I would never get involved in such lofty things.
Dick Laws doesn't really remember seeing the paper.
The policy was, I think, that the director approved everything that went out from the building.
He certainly didn't. My memory of the interview I did with him some years ago now, he didn't sit up at his desk and go, "Oh my God, this is important." There was a muted reaction within the organisation.
I think that would be certainly right. It was very unusual for Joe to publish anything. So actually getting something out would be good. Dick was a zoologist rather than a meteorologist, so it would be outside his field. And he might just say, "Yeah, the grammar's all right, fine."
I was using him as a figurehead.
Yeah.
Was there a kind of a groundswell of opinion about the paper in that gap between it being written and it appearing in Nature within Bass?
I don't think so, because most people wouldn't even know it had been
written,
sent to Nature.
Mm.
That would be just a fairly small group of people. And that's still true today. You've got no idea who's writing exciting papers. We've got a much better PR system now than we had then, so a lot of people would tell PR that there's a really exciting paper about to come out and we better do something about it. But others quite happily just do their own little thing, follow the scientific process. And
so there was no indication at that time this was going to be the paper that
changed the earth.
Well, I was going to say enhanced Bass's reputation. Yeah. Actually, your ending of my sentence is better.
No idea at all. It was really just another, here's a exciting little discovery.
Okay.
I don't really think we understood the implications. This is a bit of science. And actually, it's created a big social change and underlined absolutely conclusively the need for long-term monitoring. Because if we hadn't had that continuous data set, we couldn't have made the discovery.
If it hadn't been for IGY.
Yeah, yeah. But also the continued funding to make the observations. So it did underlie the risk that various working groups were starting to say, "Why are you still doing those mm-hmm. measurements?" And then thereafter we could say, "This is why." And
because you never know.
That reason has been followed ever since. And despite all Bass's financial constraints, that basic environmental monitoring still continues as a key part. Largely because we understand that it underpins a lot of the research, that if you don't have that baseline, you can't say, "Well, my computer model suggests this should be happening." Well, it's not in the data, so that particular version of the model must be wrong. So there is a reliance on having that good quality data.
You commented about Joe Farman's lack of paper production. Other people have said the same. So let's go back now and discuss how that paper did get written. Well, how your information got acted upon and written. Because you were the new boy on the block. You were a rookie scientist. Yeah. You know, what does he know? Was that a struggle?
I think Joe felt that if he didn't publish, then I would. And therefore, something had to be done. He's always said, I think, that the order of the authors was based alphabetically, and he felt he ought to take responsibility because if I was wrong, then that would damage my career.
He was genuinely prepared to take the rap, was he?
I think so, yes. Yeah, I think that he felt he was the lead and therefore if it was wrong, it should be his fault, not the other.
So to get to that point, you had to go to him, knock on his door and say, I've got these statistics. So tell me about the process of convincing Brian Gardner and Joe Farman that you were right.
I think actually it didn't take much convincing once I gave them, here's the graph, because they could take one look and say, yes, the science speaks for itself. And that was one thing about our discovery. It was so clear-cut. There was virtually no scope for argument as to whether you had found anything or not.
Well, unlike
the greenhouse gas debate, is climate change happening or not? The sceptics can come up with all sorts of arguments, mostly specious, that say, well, actually, you've not measured anything. So they say, no, Antarctic Peninsula trends, no, that's a load of rubbish. It's warming at the wrong time of year and all sorts of things like that. Whereas with the ozone hole, it's absolutely clear-cut that over this station in Antarctica, there has been a dramatic drop in ozone. It's only happened since the late 1970s. It wasn't there in the 60s and 50s and early 70s. We also got away, I think, with plotting in reverse the increasing amounts of CFCs. So people would take a look at that one graph and say, oh yes, it's the CFCs, no question about it. In fact, the physics and chemistry in the paper was wrong. It wasn't the mechanism that Joe put forward. It was heterogeneous chemistry on ice clouds high in the atmosphere. But that was irrelevant to the success of the paper. We got the right results, and the results by themselves stood, but the theory turned out to be not quite right.
What was it? Was it Professor Rowland, the American, who was it looking at his work that made you start looking at comparisons between your ozone graph and CFCs?
I think it was, again, from the scientific press of the time that certainly in the early 70s it was sort of Concord plus CFCs would affect the ozone layer. And I think Concord sort of slowly faded out of the arguments. It was just the CFCs. But it wasn't really expected that Antarctica would show anything, because it should have been visible if it was happening across the globe. The theory was that there shouldn't be anywhere special. And so seeing something quite dramatic over Antarctic...
Right, so
it was unexpected.
It was already accepted that CFCs were bad for the ozone.
Yes, yeah.
What you did was to show how bad.
In one particular place.
Yeah.
And our paper was really just focused on Halley, and we couldn't say that this is an Antarctic-wide phenomena. It could just be a narrow little thing that happened to be over Halley. It was likely to be global, and there were hints of it in South Pole and the Japanese data and so on. So we were reasonably confident that other people were seeing it too, but they hadn't got the continuity that allowed them to say. On the far side of Antarctica, over McMurdo, they would be very unlikely to see anything because the spring warming happens there first. So by the time that they can start the measurements, very often the ozone depletion is finished anyway. South Pole itself, there they can't start the measurements until early October, maybe a little bit later. And again, by that time, things are beginning to finish. The ozone amounts are beginning to recover because it just happens that it's late September, early October that you see the lowest values. And Halley is actually ideally placed, because very often the ozone hole is centred over Halley, and you have the geometric conditions so that you can start the observations, because Halley is sufficiently far north, unusually, that you've got the sunlight to make the measurements with the Dobson.
Okay.
So that there were a lot of accidents that went into the discovery.
Does it occur to you sometimes that you might have missed it? Or would somebody have come up with it?
Would have come up with it. That was inevitable. The Japanese were starting to get suspicions but didn't have the continuity. The satellite people would have looked. I don't think
so. There were two forces here then, working in that period up to the Christmas 1984. There was this young, enthusiastic scientist called John Shanklin who was convinced he was right.
Yeah.
And had the desire to be first.
No, I think just convinced he was right.
And then there was the...
I don't think there's any desire to be first that came into it at that point. It was just, here's what we've got, and you've got to go ahead with this.
Well, there was...
And yes, we would have been first, but I don't think it was being first that was the driver. It was that we need to make these observations available to the scientific community.
Yeah, it would have been negligent. I think it was Brian Gardner's word, negligent, not to publish.
Yeah.
But you had the old Smoky Joe Farman, who I get the impression was always reluctant to go into print until he was absolutely sure, beyond any reasonable doubt. And at some point, a compromise must have been reached between the three of you.
I think it was between Brian and Joe, with pressure on Brian from me that was then transmitted to Joe, I think is probably more how it went.
So your junior status meant that you had to sort of work through an intermediary.
I didn't like going to his office because it was so smoky.
The point I'm getting at is, did you feel disadvantaged because you were new-ish?
No.
You were being taken as seriously?
No, I was taken seriously, there's no doubt about that.
And was it taken off your hands then by Joe?
The writing of the paper very much was.
Were you told that I'll write this?
Yes. Not in so many words, but...
Rather more words.
It was...
How was that for you?
I think initially quite disappointed, but then quite pleased that it sort of got into Nature and everything. So there were sort of two sides. One, it was sort of my thing, and it seemed... slightly unfair that everybody else's name should be on it. But the argument was that if you didn't have a theory, then the observations by themselves weren't much use. So Joe's view was that you needed to explain your observations as well as present the observations. And I couldn't come up with a theory other than saying there's a link to CFCs. Where you could say, yes, there's this correlation and it's 99.9% certain or whatever. But a correlation is not a theory. And I think Joey was quite right that you do need to have an explanation, even if your explanation isn't perhaps 100% quantified, but you definitely need to say, here's our postulated theory for why this is happening, and then it hangs together much better.
Was that something that you couldn't write?
I didn't have the technical competence to do that.
Okay. And also, is a paper better with three authors? Does it have more credibility?
It had more credibility in the sense that Brian was very good at making sure all the facts and figures balanced and checked and was grammatically spot on, and that there weren't any possible mistakes in the computing and everything else. And I think the three authors we had all complemented each other. So I drove the observations, Joe drove the chemistry, and Brian linked everything together and came up with a coherent whole. And I think without any one of those, it would never have got through.
Right. And then we get to December 1984, when it had to be written, redrafted, and then posted. What are your memories of that pre-Christmas period?
Not much, actually. I can remember Brian coming to me and saying, we need to redo this particular graph. But other than that, it was Brian and Joe that were largely doing the drafting. And I think also memories have faded. So,
yeah. Are you being there was nothing kept in the loop at that point?
On the fringes of the loop, I would say.
Right. Yeah. So were you aware of last-minute panics about should we or shouldn't we post this letter to Nature?
Not really. But I think I was aware that if they didn't post it, then right, my draft will come out again.
There was another smoking gun, which is the one that you held to their heads.
A little bit, yes. And I think they were aware of that, that if they didn't, then I would. And that was sort of part of the deal, that we'll do it together rather than one of us doing it and it going off half-cocked.
So what was making you hold that gun to their heads? You see, if you said earlier, being first didn't really matter. What did matter enough to you to make them...
Doing it.
Right.
Because, as you said, Joe is always reluctant to actually publish anything. And this was something I thought, yes, we need to do it. However, I think the same criticism can be levelled against me, that I've never published terribly much, at least for Bass. For some other organisations, there's sort of one or two publications a year. And whether that's Bass not being able to utilise me enough or management or whatever is another matter. But through the Bass part of the career, I've only got a relatively small number of papers. The focus was on the data. And largely, with data, you don't publish papers on it. You just say, here it is, and it's available. So I've, for the Bass part of my work, I've always made sure that the data is publicly available. There's a web page with it all on. You can just go and get it and help yourself. We understand it better, so beware of misinterpreting what we make available. And I follow that into many other areas of the science that I'm involved in. So one area is comets. So I'm the director of the British Astronomical Association's comet section and the Society for Popular Astronomy's comet section. And all the data there is publicly available on the web page. But on comets, I publish sort of one or two papers a year. And then, again, botany, I've published partly refereed papers. And again, it's sort of one or two a year. But the data is there and publicly available, because I think that's a key thing that I've gained from here. The Antarctic Treaty says you'll make all your data publicly available. So that's what we do.
Okay.
As soon as we get it,
it goes
up on the web.
Did you see the paper before it was posted?
Yes.
You approved it?
I had the copy. And
did you approve it? Or?
I think I just said, yeah, that looks all right. it's got a graph on it. So all my data's there. So I was happy that it had gone off. Yeah.
Okay. There's now a 5-month gap between posting the envelope and it appearing in Nature magazine in 1985, which feels like a very good time to have a smoko.
Right. Okay, let's take a break.